What unique threat did Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam pose to the American establishment in the 1960s? How might the black radical tradition of Malcolm and Martin King inform contemporary racist policies in the era of President Donald Trump? Is it possible to challenge racial injustice without confronting capitalism? What was the significance of the MOVE organization founded by John Africa, and why did authorities seek to bomb the MOVE residents in 1985? How is the system continuing to attack Mumia Abu-Jamal and other U.S. political prisoners? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we feature a retrospective on Black History Month and on some of the great movement pioneers seeking to redress the past and ongoing crimes of the racist corporate state in the face of the Trump presidency. We'll hear from commentator Abayomi Azikiwe, we'll hear from MOVE bombing survivor Ramona Africa, and we'll hear from Suzanne Ross of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. On this week's program, Revolutionary Struggle from Malcolm to Martin to MOVE to Mumia, a Black History Month special. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 24th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories facing our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available for download at the website globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Known, documented, and amply proven, the West is using organizations including ISIS and Al-Qaeda in its attempts to destroy Syria. We also know that the West used and likely continues to use depleted uranium ordnances throughout its illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. Depleted uranium ordnances are weapons of mass destruction that continue to kill innocent Iraqis and will do so for many years to come. But the recently disclosed story about the U.S. using depleted uranium ordnances in Syria is suspect, not because there is reasonable doubt that the U.S. used them, but because the story is being conflated in Western media with the notion that the weapons were used against ISIS. While the West sometimes attacks both sides to prolong the destruction and warfare, and or to create intra-Syrian conflict, the notion that the weapons were used against ISIS infrastructure is intentionally misleading in the sense that it creates the false perception that the West is trying to destroy ISIS despite on-the-ground evidence to the contrary. That comes from the article, "The Counterterrorism Campaign in Syria is Fake. Dark State Manipulations Serve as Barriers to Peace," by Mark Taliano, posted February 19th. Liberals and conservatives are now publicly allied in demonizing Putin and Russia and supporting a very dangerous military confrontation initiated by Obama and championed by the defeated Hillary Clinton. In the past, these opposed political factions accepted that they would rotate their titular leaders into and out of the White House, and whenever the need arose to depose one or the other, that business would be left to deep state forces to effect in secret, and everyone would play dumb. Now the game has changed. It's all obvious. The deep state has seemingly gone shallow. That comes from the article, "The Deep State Goes Shallow, Reality TV Coup d'Etat in Prime Time," by Edward Curtin, posted February 21st. It was supremely wicked and rapidly meandered into horse-muddied waters. U.S. President Donald J. Trump had openly expressed what many a U.S. politician has felt but avoided for the sake of false decency. The two-state solution regarding Israel and Palestine was, quote, a bad idea, unquote. There was only one supremo in this fight, and it certainly did not entail the downtrodden in Gaza or the West Bank. in his consistently inconsistent manner before a press corps he has come to loathe, Trump also claimed that he could, quote, live with two-state or one-state, unquote. Quote, I'm looking at two-state and one-state, and I like the one both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like, unquote. That comes from the article, A Tale of Two Realities, Donald Trump and Israel, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted February 20th. The Western fiat currency regime should be dissolved. Most outstanding debts should be extinguished, debt jubilee, massive write-offs, large-scale revaluations, and national sovereignty must regain prominence across the entire globe. A balanced financial system based principally on equitable assets must take the place of the current debt-based system. Sovereign governments should look to take on the crucial role as their own primary issuer of currency. This, of course, would require much more honest and transparent governance than we currently have in place. A new system of loose, decentralized global governance should be constructed to act as an impartial arbiter in geopolitical and economic affairs. These are but a few of the possible reforms that could be made to affect a more intelligent paradigm of globalism. That comes from the article, Analyzing the Emerging World Order, The Future of Globalism, by Levon Duran, posted February 19th. While socialism as a political ideology and economic system was challenging the hegemony of capitalism and imperialism, there was the emergence of the national liberation movements throughout Africa, Asia, and Latin America, which both the socialist camp and the West were attempting to win over to the respective world outlooks. African Americans objectively had no real material interest in maintaining capitalism and imperialism. The system of exploitation and world conquest had been made possible as a result of the capital accrued from the profits generated from the Atlantic slave trade and the rise of colonialism. Hidden Figures addresses this dilemma by focusing on the role of Jim Crow as a facilitator of racial capitalism and social containment. Nonetheless, it was the African American people themselves who opened up the challenge to institutional racism in the U.S. That comes from a review of the film Hidden Figures under the headline, The U.S. Space Program and the Cold War, Historic Role of African American Women, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted February 22nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Abayomi Azikiwe is an outspoken political commentator. He's editor of Pan-African Newswire and a frequent contributor to Global Research. He spoke recently at Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan, in honor of African American History Month, where he addressed the subject of the global dimensions of the life and legacy of Malcolm X. He joins us now. Once again, sir, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
Now, we're having this conversation on the occasion that it's been 52 years since the assassination of Malcolm X. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the essential components of Malcolm X's legacy that would speak to the current political crisis.
Yeah, Malcolm X was a political being. His parents were involved in the Garvey movement. The Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was formed by Marcus Garvey in 1914 and reached its height in the 1920s. Malcolm was born in 1925. His father was also a preacher. He was a Baptist minister. And his mother had been a organizer and a writer for the Negro World newspaper, which is the newspaper of the UNIA. So yes, he grew up in a political atmosphere, but at the same time, as a result of the racism, his father was reported that was killed by a white paramilitary group in Lansing, Michigan in 1931. And the family, of course, never being able to recover from this loss, was eventually broken up during the 1930s, Malcolm lived in foster homes. He eventually went to live with an older sister in Boston in 1941, right on the eve of the United States intervention in World War II. And during the course of the war, he worked in menial jobs on the railway system, worked as a shoeshine in shoeshine shops. He also got involved in criminal activity, which landed him in prison in 1946 in the aftermath of World War II. Now, during this time period, there were tremendous upheavals that were going on in the world. And you had the whole question of national liberation movements during World War II in places such as Algeria, and also in the aftermath of World War II with the Rand Minor strike in South Africa, the beginning of the independence movement in Ghana in 1948, and so many other struggles that were taking place. The Chinese Revolution of 1949, the Vietnamese and Korean revolutions of 1945. So Malcolm X came out of prison in 1952 in a period in which there was much political ferment that was taking place. He had been converted to Islam under the Nation of Islam, headed by Elijah Muhammad. The organization was founded in Detroit in 1930. And then he became a leader during the 1950s within the Nation of Islam, bringing in nationalist ideas, militancy, and also a national image for the organization, because he was a very articulate and a very well-spoken individual who attracted a lot of new people to the Nation of Islam, particularly young people. So he was very much a part of the whole political landscape of the 1950s and the early 1960s that paralleled not only national liberation struggles internationally, but also inside the United States, the rise of the civil rights movement, and the antecedents of the Black Power movement.
Now, the other wing of the African American liberation movement was the that co-founded by Dr. King with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, in which he seemed to advocate a different approach. And it seemed as if maybe there's a bit of revisionism here, but it seemed like the Martin Luther King vision that he seemed to embody seemed a little bit easier for media at the time to digest, whereas Malcolm X, speaking on about advocating self-reliance and independent statehood and self-defense, it seemed a lot harder to digest. Can you speak to that issue of what made Malcolm X threatening to powerful interests within the U.S.?
Malcolm X talked about a lot of things that many African Americans thought about or discussed in private in terms of the hatred of racism, the hatred of the exploitative system, and why should African Americans attempt to reform or integrate into this system, that a better alternative would be to separate from it, either a migration out of the United States, back to Africa or somewhere else in the world, or breaking up the United States and setting aside 8 to 10 states within the continental United States and paying African Americans reparations for several decades until they could achieve self-reliance and independence as a state. And this was a radical departure from what the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was advocating, and even the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in its early days. Now, as the 1960s progressed, there was a coming together of both of these tendencies. King and Malcolm X, as far as I know, only met on one occasion, and that was in Washington, D.C., outside the U.S. Congress, as the Civil Rights Bill was being debated. After Malcolm X left the Nation of Islam in early 1964, he had pledged to work with all the civil rights organizations in some type of united front. He also attempted to authenticate himself as an Orthodox Muslim by going once again to Saudi Arabia. Now, he had been to Saudi Arabia in 1959, but he had gone as an emissary of Elijah Muhammad. He went again in 1964 to partake in the Hajj, the pilgrimage. And he did that for political as well as religious reasons. And at the same time, he traveled extensively to other Middle Eastern states as well as throughout the African continent. He wanted to internationalize the African-American struggle, as had been done in Angola and Mozambique and South Africa and Algeria and Ghana. He wanted to win over African heads of state, liberation movements, to raise the whole question of human rights violations against African-Americans within international bodies, particularly the United Nations. And this made him even more of a target on the part of the United States government. And that is revealed, which a lot of this material now is online, through thousands upon thousands of files from the FBI and other government agencies. They kept close tabs on Malcolm. He was under surveillance, it appears, on a 24-hour basis. And there was no sympathy or admiration from the state towards Malcolm X. And that's clearly revealed in the FBI documents, as I mentioned before, many of which have been published and are available online now.
Can you speak to the says, like I said, it's been 52 years, and I'm wondering if in the interim since his death, if you've noticed any significant distortions of who he was and what he contributed to the general understanding of the plight of African Americans within the United States.
Yes, there has been, as it has been with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as well. With respect to Malcolm X, they portray him as a figure who promoted hate and intolerance. Sometimes they'll say he, at one point, promoted hate and intolerance and then became an advocate of multiracialism and integration as a result of his travels and acceptance of Orthodox Islam. Both of these characterizations are false, and they do bring about a distorted historical perspective. Also, there's a tendency to downplay or either ignore the legacy of Malcolm X. And Martin Luther King's legacy, of course, is distorted as well because they only talk about certain phases of his work. They very rarely mention, if ever, his opposition to the war in Vietnam. His seeing the war in Vietnam as a symptom of a much deeper malady within American society, characterizing U.S. foreign policy as being imperialist. Also, he called the last 2 years of his life for guaranteed annual income for everyone, full employment for everyone inside the United States, location of inside. Actually, fighting for labor union recognition for a group of African-American sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, in the South. So if Malcolm X had not been assassinated, it would have, in all likelihood, they would have formed some type of an alliance. Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, was assassinated just like Malcolm X was. And I think the release of this documentary film on James Baldwin that came out earlier this month, where they take the text of an unfinished manuscript that Baldwin was working on at the time of his death in the late 1980s and utilize that to look at the lives of Megger Evers, who was another pioneering civil rights activist in Mississippi. He was a field secretary for the NAACP. Baldwin was also looking at Malcolm X as well as Martin Luther King. He knew all of these figures. Had good relationships with all of them. And I think all of these three figures, although they had different fields of work and worked in different geographical areas of the country had many similarities, as opposed to many scholars and analysts focus on their differences. But all of them fell victim to the racist state repression inside the United States.
And you just talked about Dr. King and the evolution in his thinking, that famous speech that he gave at Riverside Church nearly half a century ago, in which he referred to the evil triplets of not only racism, but materialism and militarism. So I'm curious to probe your own thoughts about if it's possible to substantively confront any one of those evils without confronting the others. Can you, for example, eliminate racial discrimination within a capitalist system, even a reformed, kinder, gentler, say, social democratic system?
No, I don't think you can. I think the issue of U.S. foreign policy is clearly linked with this domestic policy. All we have to do is examine the countries that have been attacked over the last quarter century, since the first Gulf War. Those countries have been in the Middle East, they have been in Africa, they have been in Latin America, they have been in the Asia Pacific and Central Asia. This is very, very important for people to recognize. The former Yugoslav Federation was bombed extensively in 1999 to break up the last bastion of a socialist economic and political system in Europe. And this, too, had its own geopolitical significance from the standpoint that now almost all of these states are part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. All of the former socialist states in Eastern Europe, and they still are being utilized as a bulwark against the now Russian Federation, which is also a source of tremendous tension in the world and also a source of attack against the presidency of Donald Trump. I do not believe that the Trump administration is any less hostile towards Russia than the previous administration of Barack Obama. If you look at the appointees that surround Trump, the policy analysts that advise him, most of them during the confirmation hearings expressed extreme hostility towards Russia, China, Iran, and any other state or non-state entity that is in opposition to U.S. imperialist foreign policy. So I don't think you can separate U.S. foreign policy from domestic policy, which is still rooted in institutional racism. Inside the United States now, African Americans are still subjected to national discriminatory practices. They still have substantially higher unemployment rates than whites do. They are still subjected to police violence, higher incarceration rates, unfavorable rulings by the courts. And this, of course, has its own economic character as well. The country was largely built on the backs of the forced removal of the indigenous people and the enslavement and exploitation of the African people. All of these three evils that Dr. King talked about at his Riverside Church speech on April 4th of 1967, and in subsequent addresses, a lot of which are coming out now and being listened to again, having been suppressed for decades, reveal his evolving ideological, political outlook. And that's why he became such a threat, not only to the FBI, but also to the Johnson administration, which had broken communications completely with Dr. King during the last year of his life.
We're currently facing major challenges with these freedom struggles, not only with the ongoing police state mechanisms by Donald Trump and his forerunners, but you also have that threat of co-option and pacification by the Democratic Party, by black representative organizations. And I'm wondering if you see anything on the horizon that suggests that real, meaningful change is not only possible but inevitable, or if those forces of co-option and pacification will prevail.
I think there is a possibility of building independent political organizations and movements. The Democratic Party is trying to get out in front of the mass dissent and opposition to the Trump administration. But in reality, they are not leading these demonstrations. Now, the right wing is trying to say that these demonstrations are being led by disgruntled Democrats. That is not the case at all. And the corporate media has a role in that, in fostering that viewpoint, because they, in most of the time, only interview people who are either officials or representatives of the Democratic Party or have that type of political orientation. So they realize that both parties are in crisis right now in the United States. I mean, the fact that Donald Trump was able to essentially walk in off the street, having held no political office prior to becoming president, and not only gained the nomination easily for the Republican Party, but also secure victory over Hillary Clinton, who was a veteran politician. She, of course, was not appealing to large numbers of people, even within her own constituency. A lot of people who did not vote, a lot of people who switched and voted for Trump because they did not want what Hillary Clinton represented, and were dissatisfied with the 8 years of the Barack Obama administration, which came in with a lot of hope, and a lot of people had the hope that Obama was going to make some fundamental changes. That did not happen, and that served to fuel the Trump campaign. He won the Electoral College by a comfortable margin. The problem he has, though, is that he was almost 3 million votes short in terms of electoral majority in the United States. You can also count the people who did not vote at all, which was a substantial portion of the electorate, perhaps half or if not more than half. And his policies have tended to alienate large sectors of the U.S. Population. So he has a serious problem. And if he's offending the corporate media and elements within the intelligence community, he's really in a very precarious situation in terms of maintaining any type of stable administration. Even people in the Republican Party, for example, John McCain, when he went to the Munich Security Conference earlier this month, characterized the Trump administration as being in disarray. This is almost unprecedented to have this type of split within the Republican Party itself. So I think Trump is a reflection of the instability of the American political system. And I think in the next few years, we're going to see a breaking up of both the Republican and the Democratic parties and a new political landscape that will come into being.
Abiyomi Azikiwe, I want to thank you very much for these valuable reflections. It's always great to have you on the show.
Okay, thank you for inviting me.
We've been speaking with Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, political commentator, and frequent contributor to Global Research. You can find his articles at the site panafricannews.blogspot.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The Move 9 were profiled in an interview from January 2016. They were 9 members of the Move family, a group adhering to the principles of protecting life, founded by John Africa. In 1978, they were rounded up in a police raid on their house in Powelton Village, found guilty for the death of police officer James Ramp, and sentenced to 30 to 100 years behind bars. The incarceration of these individuals and the bombing attack on their home 7 years later has been seen by MOVE supporters as an attack on a movement challenging a violent and unjust system rather than consistent with the principles of law and order. Ramona Africa is the only adult survivor of the MOVE bombing of 1985. The Global Research NewsHour caught up with Ramona during our July 2016 coverage of the Democratic National Convention to get her thoughts about MOVE, systemic violence, and the role of conventional politicians in instigating change. Could I ask you maybe a personal question? You've spoken about the influence that Mr. John Africa and his messages had on you. Could I maybe get a bit of a portrait from before you encountered him and how you made that transition?
Oh, yeah. I was raised by my mother, never knew my father. He left her before I was even born. So I was raised by my mother, and I have quite a few, or had quite a few aunts and uncles. And I was raised in a middle class Black family, went to Catholic school for 12 years, first to 12th grade. Worked for about 6 months after I graduated from high school, and didn't like too much, you know, the work I was doing. It was a so-called good job at the Philadelphia Electric Company, benefits and everything. But I just couldn't see myself there 25 years later, you know. So I left and went to Temple University. My plan was to become a lawyer. And I graduated from Temple. Was going to go to law school that fall, but I met MOVE in the spring of 79, like in March. And I just, once I met MOVE, first MOVE supporters before I even met MOVE members, and was encouraged to go over to City Hall and sit in on some of the MOVE trials, since I wanted to be a lawyer, you know, see firsthand what goes on in these trials. And my mother was in one ear telling me, you can be whatever you want to be a doctor, be a lawyer, you can be the first Black woman Supreme Court justice. I mean, I was heavily entrenched in the system, and no getting around that. I was planning to do just that, be a lawyer, then maybe a judge, and maybe a Supreme Court justice. After I met MOVE and started sitting in on those trials, I was aghast. I was in shock, because nothing that these Temple University, where I went, that's my alma mater, it's where I graduated from, none of the professors here at Temple University told me the truth about what happens in those courtrooms. None of the textbooks that I was made to read told the truth about what was happening in those courtrooms. So when I really saw it and really start talking to MOVE people and seeing the truth, that was it. I did not go to law school, although I'm fully equipped, thanks to John Africa, to represent myself in court, which I did, you know. But I did not go to the systems law school. And really, system officials like this judge, Lynn Abraham, really kicked me right on into MOVE, because she sent me to prison for contempt for 60 days. And MOVE women were in the county jail. And I spent 2 months, 60 days, up close and personal with MOVE women. There was no turning back after that. When I walked out of that prison after those 60 days, that was it. That was it. So that's how I ended up in MOVE. That was the portrait of my life before MOVE.
And have you continued to grow over the course of that period now, more than half your life?
Absolutely. One thing that people don't realize is that while MOVE's belief is in life and we work diligently on behalf of life, the real revolution is here. This system have trained and tricked people so badly that we don't realize how deep the system goes in us. And the real work, the most important work, which we will never stop doing while we're alive on this level of life, is working it off of us. That work never ends. I mean, you know, we will never get all of this system out of us while we're on this level. It's just ongoing work. We'll get better. We'll get stronger. We'll get clearer about the importance of life and more uncompromising with that. But the system is deeply entrenched in us. We don't realize how much we take for granted as right, acceptable, okay, that isn't, that the system trained us.
I think I hear what you're saying because, I mean, I think I've used the term colonialism when it comes to these sorts of issues. I'm there's a much more, a very pronounced problem within Canada with regard to the way the native peoples are dealt with by police and by the wider society. And the sense that just, we may even think like here in Temple University or the university where I'm situated, people may learn things and know them in an intellectual way, but then instinctively they continue to behave as if they're colonized, as if they're controlled, and at this racist level.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I am the least likely suspect to be a MOVE member, a revolutionary. My mother was a beautician by trade. She, quote unquote, did my hair from the time I was a little girl. Just the hair alone should have turned me off, but it didn't. It didn't. I had never had any run-ins or brutal run-ins with cops growing up. I read about them. You know, I knew about the Panthers. I knew who Angela Davis was. I knew who Fred Williams was, you know. I like you said, I knew about this intellectually, but I'm the least likely suspect to have become a MOVE member. And like I said earlier, for real, it's this system. It's supporters and people that believe in it that really pushed me right on into MOVE.
So you have to, do you have to live in a community in order to stay true to those ideals?
I would say yes, because we don't really have the strength and the wherewithal to just do this on our own. I mean, we would try to remain true. There are people that have left MOVE. You know, not really most of them because they had a problem with MOVE, but it was the intimidation and brutality coming from the cops, the threat of jail, you know. They just couldn't handle it. But they left, and in their minds, they were going to, you know, keep doing the things that, you know, they did in MOVE, even health-wise. Running, exercising, or eating a certain way and all that. And they just couldn't do it on their own. That's why family is so important. Family is the backbone of MOVE, you know, looking out for each other, encouraging each other, correcting each other when we stray from what's right, you know.
If you could clarify a detail about the authorities, quote unquote, saw MOVE as a threat. Was it the sense of love? Was it the sense of family? Was it sheer vindictiveness?
It was the wisdom of John Africa, because the information that John Africa amassed in this system, I mean, just really exposing this system's vindictiveness and hatred of life, really, of life. They couldn't tolerate that. They couldn't have that. Because when we put out information given us by John Africa, there was nothing those who run this system could do to deny it and you know, dispute it. They couldn't do it. I'm going to have to go.
I wanted to ask one more question. We're in the lead up to this Democratic National Convention, and I was wondering what you've noticed or seen on the ground in the lead up in terms of the way the police are behaving, the politicians. Is there any sense of impending something?
They know that people are getting sick and tired and frustrated with the status quo, you know. Certainly the police killings, you know, but really across the board, people are, I mean, they've been working for $15 an hour, you know, jobs, been pushing for that for a while. Now, people can't live on minimum wage, and people are just frustrated. They're really not trying to hear any nonsense, and they don't really see any solution in either candidate. And to me, that's a good thing, because it's past time people stop looking to a politician or anybody else to make things right for them, because it's not going to happen. The work, the commitment has to come from the people. And I think folks are being pushed to that point now. And I see that as a good thing.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of America's most high-profile political prisoners. Originally placed on death row for the shooting death of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, his case has been reviewed. He is now serving a life sentence, but the campaign to free Mumia lives on. Mumia has been facing threats to his life as he is ailing from untreated hepatitis C, which the state correctional institution in which he is located has been denying him that treatment. His situation has been complicated by poor water quality in the prison. Suzanne Ross is a clinical psychologist, a longtime anti-imperialist activist, and a representative of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She spoke to us a year ago about Mumia's situation and joins us again right now for an update. Suzanne, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Good morning, Michael. It's good to be on again. Always like to get the word out on our brother.
The last time we spoke, you talked about the situation with the hepatitis C that he was ailing from, and that you were before the courts trying to help get Mumia the treatment that he so desperately needs. And I was wondering if you could maybe speak to any updates on the legal front.
Yes, I definitely can. And it's important to note, from the get-go, and to kind of make people aware that this case, as wonderful as Mumia is, and as amazing a revolutionary as he is, a writer, a journalist, everything that he is, everything that's about his case affects thousands of other people. And he has been in that role historically almost from the start. His presence on death row originally, where he was placed in 1982, and his book, Live from Death Row, brought the humanity of the people who are on death row to millions of people around the world. That book was translated into I don't know how many languages. I know Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and many, many people, students and young activists in particular all over the world learned about not only his case, but what death row meant and how horrible it was that thousands of people were placed in death row and, you know, with just a sense that they were barbarians and horrible people who deserved to die instantly. And Mumia really exposed how many of them were innocent to begin with, and secondly, how many of them were wonderful people who had made a mistake or had done something in their youth that they had overcome but could never get away from the death penalty. So we're in the same situation now where Mumia, who got sick about 2 years ago, he had contracted hepatitis C when he was shot in the original incident for which he was held guilty, but he was shot by the cops and beaten up on the way to the prison, on the way to the hospital, and was in very, very bad shape and needed emergency transfusions, and that's how he got contracted hepatitis C, through those transfusions. But the prison never did anything about it, never even let him know he had hepatitis C, until he was transferred off death row in 2011, and he found out he has this illness. But he wasn't very sick at that time, and so he kind of let it go. He asked about it. They offered no treatment. And around 2 years ago, he got very, very sick, and some of your listeners probably saw that horrific picture of him when he was so ill, where the picture of death was all over that picture, all over him, and everyone who saw it thought, oh my God, this brother's dying. And he really did almost die, and had it not been for the movement, which intervened actively and immediately and nonstop, he would not be alive today. There's no question that he was on his road to death. He did, you know, under the pressure of the movement, he did get some kind of attention. He was taken to hospital. He was given emergency diagnosis, and so they began to see, first of all, that they had given him steroids to deal. He had originally had this skin disease that they couldn't diagnose, which turned out to be a symptom of hepatitis C. Not that the prison discovered that, but outside doctors diagnosed that. And they were treating him for this skin disease with steroids, which caused the diabetes, and he was close to diabetic shock and was very, very ill. So they made some adjustments. But Mumia's lawyers went to court, now it's about over a year ago, more like a year and a half ago, demanding immediate treatment and demanding this cure that is available. There is a cure out there that's very expensive in the United States, but quite inexpensive in several other countries, and could be made inexpensive if the corporation, if the pharmaceuticals weren't so greedy. At any rate, the lawyers and the movement began demanding that he get this treatment, and the Department of Corrections first claimed he didn't have hepatitis C, then they said they couldn't give him this medication, and so there was finally a court hearing, which was unusual that they would grant a court hearing, an in-person court hearing. Mumia was not in courtroom except by television. And so we could see him, and he testified. And we testified as well. The lawyers testified, and two of us, including myself, testified on his behalf as friends. And the courtroom was packed, and they had to get an overflow room to get to accommodate all the people. Remember, this is not in Philadelphia or New York. This is in... I'm trying to remember the name of the town. It's halfway between New York and Harrisburg, the capital. But anyway, he's in this courtroom and with supporters and a spirit that's very, very inspiring. And you could see the judge is impressed and is impressed by Mumia, who testifies so impressively, and by Mumia's doctor, who was very impressive, describing how sick he was. And this is Mumia's doctor again, who was brought in by us, not his official doctor in the prison. And the prison people were outrageous, denying serious illness, saying they were treating him. one of the lawyers actually perjured herself. She changed the testimony of a doctor. She actually changed the text. And the doctors sounded, forgive the, this is not a hyperbole, this is really not, the doctors resembled Nazi doctors in their lack of compassion, their willingness to have thousands of people die from an illness which they weren't treating. Well, lo and behold, about a year later, this past January, January 3rd of this year, 1 year later, we're thinking the judge is not responding. People knew the judge was sympathetic, but, you know, often liberal judges cave in under political pressure. He issued a ruling saying that Mumia is entitled to this medicine and that the Department of Corrections is obligated to give it to him immediately, within 21 days, and that to deny him this treatment when he's as ill as he is tantamount to a violation of the Eighth Amendment, the violation that protects all of us against cruel and unusual punishment. That, in fact, denying him that medication is a form of cruel and unusual punishment. We were shocked. I mean, some of us were really shocked because it was such a strong statement in support of what we were all saying, and so clear about the outrage of their denying him this treatment. And, of course, everyone else who's not getting it, which is 6,000 to 7,000 other prisoners in Pennsylvania alone. Well, in the process, we found that this hepatitis C is spread all over the prisons in the United States and in many communities, that the lack of treatment is, in fact, this huge scandal, an epidemic, an illness of epidemic proportion right now in this country that is being ignored, and because of the greed of the pharmaceutical companies, it costs them $62 to produce the full medication. You know, the medication involves a pill a day for 3 months. It costs the company $62 to produce this pill. On the market, it costs approximately $94,000. I'm going to repeat it, $94,000. 3 month treatment being the pill is $1,000 a pill. And that's how much it costs if you go on the market and try to buy it. Of course, if you have insurance or if you have some other channel for getting it, can be much cheaper. So this is what the reality of the situation is. And when the judge ordered this within 21 days, the 21 days, of course, are now up and have been up since January 24th. And yet on the last day, like the 20th or the 21st day, the lawyers filed an appeal. They wanted the judge to review his decision and change his decision, and now they filed it to the Third Circuit as well. They're trying to appeal this and prevent Mumia from getting this medication. So this is now turning out to be a huge issue, as I said, not only for Mumia, who is very sick. I mean, he's not as sick as he was 2 years ago. He's much better. But he still has this hepatitis C, this constant itching. He's taking a horrible medication to reduce the itching that's quite toxic, but he can't live without it. He said he can't think straight. He can't do anything if he doesn't have at least several hours a day where he's not itching. The form of the skin disease was this horrible, nonstop itching. On top of that, the prison, it turned out the water at Mahanoy Prison, where Mumia is, a few months ago, the problem started where it would be brown, smelly, and even black. And Mumia, one of the things the prison, the DOC, Department of Corrections, is doing to cover their you-know-what is they say they give him treatment, even though they're not giving him the only medicine that can cure it. They say they give him treatment. He's supposed to take these three therapeutic baths a week. Well, he goes to the bathroom, you know, to the bath to go get in the bath, and he looks at this dark, filthy water, and he says, I'm not getting into that. And one of the guards originally said, and I quote the guard, you'd have to be retarded to agree to take a bath in that water. And so that's happened again and again. And there is no clean drinking water either, and there is no clean water that can be even purchased for those who might be able to afford it from their commissary. In the visiting room at Mahanoy, and I know this from my direct experience, I thought I was buying water, And the only thing is this horrible tasting flavored water that has all kinds of chemicals in it. And you can't buy plain water. And in the commissary, you can't buy plain water. So you really are at the mercy of the prison. All of this is now part of the struggle. And, of course, water, the slogan has become water is life. And, is, you know, from Standing Rock to Flint to the prisons. And this is an issue for our society as a whole, which especially under the Trump administration, things can only be expected to be worse if we don't really watch out and fight what is happening around the pollution of this incredible source of life and necessity for life, water. So we are involved in several campaigns. We've been at the Department of Corrections several times. We've been at the governor's office. We've demonstrated at the prison, in front of the prison to let other families, those, you know, Mumia's family, of course, knows all this, but a lot of times the brothers inside, or the sisters inside, don't want their families to worry about them and don't tell them. So one day, about a few months ago, we were outside Mahanoy on a Sunday, stopping visitors and telling them what's happening. They said, most of them, in fact, all of them, have said they had not heard anything about this. Well, we knew this was going on. And when we spoke to the brothers inside, they certainly knew, but the families didn't know. We need families, community, and everybody to know about this. Mm-hmm. So we have several. We've had phone call campaigns, and we've had, now we're waiting on the legal front. We're waiting for what either the judge or the Third Circuit will do about this appeal. The appeals by the Department of Corrections have been filed, and counter-filings have been made by our attorneys demanding immediate treatment and saying this is outrageous, that Mumia has still not gotten it way after the deadline that was set by the judge. And appeals, of course, can delay a whole process, but there's no reason they have to. You can keep on appealing. In the meantime, follow the order of the judge and, you know, decide that it's not going to be spread to other prisoners or whatever. But they have other options. They don't have to deny, be this 100% denial of treatment, which is what they're engaging in.
What can be done when you're talking about something as simple as an appeal,
right,
that's, well, able to enable this kind of genocidal set of conditions?
Right. I think that's we talked about that, as a matter of fact, on... We just had a meeting this past weekend in Philadelphia, and we talked about it as a genocidal strategy. If you're denying water to people, I mean, people get sick. Brian Arroyo said that when he tries drinking this water, if he drinks more than a little sip, he has to immediately go to the bathroom. Other people have developed dysentery-like symptoms. People can't live without water. I mean, they buy juice. They try to buy, you know, a lot of them drink soda, of course, which is terrible for them. You know, that's the situation. I'm thinking, we've been thinking of maybe taking it to some international arena and filing this as a human rights issue. We've had some luck with that before. I mean, in terms of publicity, not that anything has happened, but in terms of getting the word out, we have had some success in getting the word out by claiming and demand, you know, claiming correctly that outrageous things are going on in Mumia's case, but this is thousands of others.
Suzanne Ross, it's been delightful to hear from you again. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for calling.
That was Suzanne Ross, spokesperson with the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. For more information on Mumia, the March 1st Water is Life Day of Action, and how to help, please visit the website www.freemumia.com. You've been listening to a special Black History Month edition of the Global Research News Hour. Our show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca and airs on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show also airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.